Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, give you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. Please note that if this year we use your question, which you postmark any time between now and December 31st, you will get not the usual $10 in war stamps, but a $50 war bond, plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get in addition $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenthal. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information, Please, spontaneous and unrehearsed as ever, offers tonight its veteran trio, John Kieran of the New York Sun, Oscar Levant, and Franklin P. Adams, and proudly welcomes as its guest the eminent artist and distinguished virtuoso of the piano, Mr. Arthur Rubinstein. But now, ladies and gentlemen, before we begin, here's something that some of our listeners have written in about. You see, our experts are so darn bright, concern them, that once in a while they start answering before the question's been completely presented, or if it's a musical question, before Mr. Kahn has finished playing. Now, we're all agreed that that's not fair to you listeners who are playing the Information Please game along with us. So remember, experts, wait till the question is finished before you raise your hands. Is that clear? Okay, here we go. Now, the first one comes from Aaron Sussman of New York City. It's a simple question. Get 2 out of 3. Mr. Sussman wants you to identify these painters. One painter was also a bullfighter. Who was that? A painter who was also a bullfighter on the side. Mr. Rubinstein.
Goya?
Goya is quite right. Was he a professional bullfighter?
No, but he took part in games. He liked it very much. He made marvelous pictures about them, as he was probably dreaming about them. He made also nightmares about them.
Yes, yes, remarkable. They were etchings.
They were pictures, yes.
Yes, etchings. The Art of Bullfighting, I think, yes. The series is called.
The great expert.
Yes, the great Spanish painter, Francisco Goya. Now, what painter was also a military engineer? Mr. Kieran.
Leonardo da Vinci.
Quite right. Can you name any of his military inventions, Mr. Kieran?
Well, he invented, he improved a catapult, I believe.
That's right.
And he did a lot of military engineering.
Great deal of it. Mr. Rubinstein?
He's also Michelangelo, was also a military engineer.
Was he?
Yes, he made fortifications in Florence.
Is that so?
Piazzale Michelangelo, which was a wonderful fortification on the...
I'll take that, Mr. Rubinstein, Mr. Levant.
Adolf Hitler was a painter and an engineer. He looked what he engineered.
Perfectly true. Hadn't thought of it. Now, another painter who wrote the opposite of How to Make Friends and Influence People. Mr. Kieran.
The Gentle Art of Making Enemies by James Abbott McNeil Whistler.
Yes, that's the fellow. He was the man who owes everything to his mother. Isn't that right, Mr. Kieran?
He's the man who went to West Point, didn't get through, and said if silicon had been a gas, he would have been a major general.
By golly, that's right. That was the thing he flunked in.
He flunked in chemistry.
True enough. Good thing he got flunked. Hooray for silicon. Try this one from Durwood W. Killinger of Joliet, Illinois. This is a musical question, gentlemen. What is the original melody and who wrote the piano paraphrase or arrangement of what you're going to hear? In other words, you're going to hear a paraphrase or arrangement of a melody. You have to give us the original melody and tell us who wrote the paraphrase. Is that clear, Mr. Rubinstein and Mr. Levant? They're going to be three of them. Let's have the first. I have both Mr. Rubinstein and Mr. Levant. We'll call on our guest first. Mr. Rubinstein?
It's a paraphrase of the Fledermaus, the bat of Strauss.
Yes, and who wrote the paraphrase?
The paraphrase is by Godowsky.
That's quite right. Is that a hard question, Mr. Rubinstein?
It's a hard piece. It's a very hard.
Very hard. And well,
Levant plays it marvelously, I'm sure.
I haven't played it since Godowsky does.
Now try the second. These get harder. I still have Mr. Rubinstein and Mr. Levant. Now, Mr. Levant.
I think I would like to share it with Mr. Levant. May we?
Yes.
But you can say the other part.
Well, it's by Liszt on Verdi, Rigoletto, and let's sing it.
Oh, no, that we don't have to do. Isn't that the quartet?
Yeah, the Ringo, I Want to Sing It with the Boys.
That's right, and there's paraphrases by Liszt. Now the third and last. You know, it would be nice to hear from Mr. Kieran or Mr. Adams.
Oh, sure, no, who wrote it, but not the paraphrase.
Well, who wrote it, Mr.
It's
Kieran?
The Blue Danube.
Yes, now, Sparrows is right. Now, Mr. Rubenstein?
Schulz-Ebler
wrote the paraphrase. Why did he want to write a paraphrase of the original?
It's very effective. Because he knew of pianists like some of our present here, you know, who can play it marvelously.
You're rather coy, Mr. Rubenstein. Mr. Levan?
He wrote it for money.
Is that true?
Yeah, he got a copyright.
Never mentioned on this program, Mr. Levan. Goodness gracious. Try this from Ernest Halsey, Jr. of Griffin, Georgia. You can get your minds away from music, Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran. In these quotations, quote the line that follows the word but. In each of these quotations, I'm going to say a line that ends with the word but. You give me the words that follow that. The first is, to dance to flutes, to dance to lutes is delicate and rare, but, Mr. Kieran?
It is not sweet with nimble feet to dance upon the air. That's from the Ballad of Reading Jail by Oscar Wilde.
You see, Mr. Rubenstein, Mr. Kieran has his talents, too.
Wonderful.
That's quite wrong.
I'll give all my music for that.
I'll try.
All right. Mr. Adams, you draw up the contract after the show is over. All right, now here's another quotation ending with but. You can bring Rose with a turned-up nose, but, Mr. Levant.
Don't bring Lulu.
That's right. Lulu. It's a song, when was it popular?
Well, about 15 years ago. Yes. Maybe more.
Yes, about 1925, during Mr. Adams' later or blue period. here's another but quotation. No, you won't eat nothing else, but... No, you won't eat Mr. Kieran.
But them spicy... Eastern smells and the temple bells and all that. It's Kipling on the Road to Mandalay.
Yes, you've got the essence of it, Mr. Kieran. And look at Mr. Rubenstein. He's admiring you, Mr. Adams.
But me no buts.
Well, that finishes me. I've got to go on to the next question, Mr. Adams. Just to straighten out Mr. Kieran's practically perfect quotation, no, you won't eat nothing else but them spicy garlic smells and the sunshine and the palm trees and the tinkly temple bells. You forgot the garlic part of it, Mr.
I don't like garlic.
So it's same. Freudian omission. Now, the next one is from Gerald M. Carney of Pittsburgh, Kansas. And this is a question involving the French horn. What orchestral works start this way? We're going to have three of them on the French horn, and we're supposed to get two out of three. Let's have the first. I have two hands again, and it's a great surprise to me that Mr. Rubenstein and Mr. Levan. Mr. Rubenstein.
Let's share this with Levan, I think.
All right, sure.
I will see Brahms, and he will see the number of the symphony.
All right. Second symphony, first act.
I want to warn our audience that this really is an unrehearsed and spontaneous program, despite this efficient collaboration between our two pianists. Now the second opening of an orchestral work. Mr. Rubenstein.
Till Eulenspiegel of Strauss.
Yes, and Mr. Levant was no doubt going to say the same thing. And now the third and last. Mr. Levan?
Mr. Rubenstein made a wonderful recording of that. That's the Brahms B-flat concerto, and I will share his royalties.
I would like to speak about that concerto that I'm going to play the day after tomorrow in Cleveland.
You're going to play it again tomorrow?
It frightens me to hear it. Yes,
yes.
The day after tomorrow.
Well, that gives us three out of three. It's very hard to stump these musicians this evening. Try this one from J.O. Cuthbert of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Name, let's say three people of the past or present whose names, either the first or the last name, indicate some period of time. Oh, a week or a month or a year or whatever. Mr. Adams.
Clarence Day.
Clarence Day, yes. The original author of Life with Father. Mr. Kieran.
Century Milstead, a Yale football player of some renown.
Not up to this moment here.
Oh, he was on the great 1923 football team.
Negative. Century Milstead.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Mr. Levant.
Leopold Auer.
Leopold Auer, very good. Had a nice musical reminiscence, too.
You like it?
And while you're with the Auers, why not Misha Auer?
Well, Leopold's older.
That gives us three. Can you think of any others? Mr. Adams, did one come to you?
Must be persons?
Yes, must be people. Mr. Levant?
Eric Knight.
Eric Knight, yes. Eric Knight, the author, Mr. Adams?
Charles II.
Very good. Very good. I think we'll end on that one, Mr. Adams. Now, here's a question for our Heinz 57 reporter, Ben Grauer. Who was it, Ben, that said, until the nature of man is completely altered, cooking is the most important thing for a woman?
Well, that was the English novelist Arnold Bennett. And it's a living truth that man's nature hasn't changed when it comes to a taste for homespun flavor. Neither has woman's instinct for pleasing her menfolk. But nowadays, instead of cooking those traditional but time-taking favorites, the thick and lusty soups of yesterday, she serves delicious Heinz soups. Every one of Heinz's hearty condensed soups is packed with old-fashioned goodness. And it's no wonder. Because there is no finer flavor combination in the world than the rich puree of sun-ripened tomatoes and thick cream. Heinz condensed cream of tomato soup has that unmistakable home taste because it's made in small batches according to a prized old-time recipe. Rare, delicate spices are blended in so that even the aromatic wisps of steam from a bowl of Heinz cream of tomato soup are positively tantalizing to a hungry man. So make your meals more nourishing, extra tempting, by starting them off with Heinz condensed cream of tomato soup.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now a question from George P. Abel of Steubenville, Ohio. Here are three questions about famous fortunes that occur in literature or plays or the movies. Let's get two out of three. What deported convict leaves a fortune to a boy who has helped him? Mr. Adams.
I think that is in Our Mutual Friend.
You've got the right author, but you're in the wrong novel.
T.D.R. Bleak House.
Try another novel. You can go through the whole set in about 8 minutes.
I surrender with those two.
Well, you certainly have the right author. It's Charles Dickens, and it's in Great Expectations. The convict, Abel Magwitch, helps the hero, Pip, with money for his education, but the end, the fortune is confiscated. Does it come back to you now, Mr. Adams?
It does. I read all of them aloud, and I kind of forget them.
I'm surprised you have any voice left. Try the second one. Who acquires a fortune through information given him by a fellow convict? Mr. Curran.
The Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes.
Edmond Dantes.
Yes, Edmond Dantes.
Abbe Faria was his fellow convict, and he died in prison.
Yes. Yeah. In what form was the fortune, Mr. Curran?
It was, was in diamonds and rubies, most of it.
Yes, jewels of various sorts. Mr. Levant?
He told you the whole story.
So there's a little more to it than that.
Not more.
Six volumes.
But it's all amounts to that.
Try this one. Who inherits a fortune which almost lands him in an insane asylum when he tries to give it away? Mr. Levant.
Gary Cooper in Mr. Deeds goes his turn.
Yes, that's right. Mr. Deeds is played by Gary Cooper. Very good and very quick. Now the next one from James K. Svensson of Norman, Oklahoma is again a 2 out of 3 question. And it's all about poets. Can you name a poet, an English poet, who died in a brawl? Died in a brawl, Mr. Curran?
Kit Marlowe, at an early age.
Yes, quite right.
Tavern brawl.
Can you give us an approximate date for the death of Christopher Marlowe?
Let's see, 1500 and around 50 or so?
A little later than that, 1593.
Oh, was this late?
Yes, as late as that. He was killed in Deptford, not far from London, in a drunken brawl. Can you name a Russian poet who died in a duel? A Russian poet, Mr. Rubinstein.
Lermontov.
Lermontov was one. How did that do
it? Pushkin, the other one.
Yeah.
Are there more than
Russian poets? Pushkin was also in a duel, yes.
But his brother-in-law.
Is that an occupational disease among Russian poets?
I think with his brother-in-law. No? All right.
No, he died of wounds received in a duel with a Frenchman, I think.
Pushkin?
Pushkin, yes.
You're wrong.
He was a Russian, but...
He was a Russian.
Foreign name.
I'll bet you.
How much?
Anything you want. This is serious.
Gee, you mean he's looking it up, though, Mr. LeMay.
All right, we'll lay it in a bag.
All right, we'll see whether it's his brother-in-law or not. Pushkin and Lermontov, two famous Russian poets, both died in a duel.
No, my bet is he's not a Frenchman, the brother-in-law.
Oh, I tell you, Rubinstein said that he wasn't a Frenchman.
Oh, that Rubinstein.
I'll stick along with that. Name an American poet who died in battle. Mr. Kieran.
Joyce Kilmer.
Joyce Kilmer, yes. The Second Battle of the Marne. Was there another, Mr. LeBron?
No, that's one.
Alan Seeger, I think, was another. Mr. Adams, you're a poet yourself, and also used to be in the life insurance business.
Otis Ferguson of the New Republic died, I think, in the Maritime.
He was
a semi-poet.
I had no idea that he
yes, it was very terrible news to me. I read about it.
Sorry to hear that. Sure. It seems that poets, Mr. Adams, have a rather high life insurance premium.
James Elroy Flecker also died, I think, in battle.
He died of disease, I think, at Gallipoli. I don't think in battle, though I'm not sure about that. Let's try this one, gentlemen, from Richard S. Kirby of New Haven, Connecticut. Again, get 2 out of 3. And it would be a nice thing for the United States Treasury if you'd mess up a few of these questions instead of sliding along this way. Quote a line of poetry or song about a weasel. You all know what a weasel is, Mr. Adams.
Pop! Goes the weasel.
Beautiful. And is there any other line of poetry in which a weasel appears? Mr. Kieran?
Yes, but I don't recall it. It's in Aylmer's Field by Tennyson, right near the end.
About how many lines from the end?
About 3 or 4 lines from the end. It winds up with the rabbit fondling its own...
Don't bet him.
I suppose no, I won't.
Harmless face and all his open field.
I'm sure that's right. I was thinking of a famous colloquy between Hamlet and Polonius about a weasel. Does that come back to you, Mr. Kieran? Methinks it is like a weasel.
Mighty like a weasel.
Yes.
That's right.
It's a cloud.
That's right. It's more like a whale, very like a whale. How about a line in which little foxes appear? Little foxes. Mr. Levant.
Oh, no, I thought you were going to say... I don't know.
All right.
That's a play.
It is a play, Mr. Kieran.
Yeah. Bible.
From the Song of Song, which is Solomon's.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's about grapes.
The little foxes
that spoil the grapes.
That spoil the vines or the grapes. That's quite right. Also, A.A. Milne has a line about little foxes. Once upon a time, there were 3 little foxes who didn't wear stockings and didn't wear socks. A.A. Milne. That gives us a weasel, little foxes. Now, how about a squirrel, a line of poetry in which a squirrel pops up? Mr. Adams.
That's Emerson.
Right. Give us the line.
The mountain and the squirrel.
Yes.
The mountain called the squirrel a little prig, something like that.
Yes, that's right. Mountain and the squirrel had a quarrel, and the former called that a little prig from The Mountain and the Squirrel by R.W. Emerson. How about this one from Dr. Paul Wolfe of Lansing, Michigan? This is an interesting musical question, gentlemen, involving the use of 2 pianos, 2 of them. Count them. And you're going to hear these 2 pianos playing 2 different compositions at the same time. That means one is playing one composition, one is playing the other. All you have to do is separate them and give us the names of the 2 compositions that are being played simultaneously. Is that clear?
We'll split.
I really think you ought to get that the one who answers should give the 2 compositions.
Right.
In other words, either Mr. Rubinstein and Mr. Levant, or if you want to drop dead with surprise, Mr. Adams or Mr. Kieran. Now let's have the first set. Of our 2 pianists, Mr. Levant had his hand up first. He's going to give us the 2 compositions that were played.
They're both 2 Chopin etudes, one the Black Key, the other Butterfly.
That's right.
And they're both... That's arranged for 1 piano by the aforementioned Mr. Godofsky again.
It is?
Yeah.
Does that make it easier or harder?
It's very hard. I just looked at it and got vertiginous.
I mean, was it hard to get the answer?
No, it's not hard to get the answer. It's hard to play it.
Well, it seems magical to me. Now, let's have the next set of simultaneous compositions. Now, Mr. Rubinstein.
The one is Faust.
Yeah.
But the other...
The other was hard to hear.
That's true.
Mr. Rubinstein's right.
Do you want to have it played again? All right, will you play for these apparently suddenly deaf pianists?
The other one is Aida.
What was that again, Mr.?
The other was Aida.
Yes, they're both the Marches.
Aida March.
Yes, from Paul's Aida and from Gounod's spouse. That's quite right. And Mr. Levant, you were going to say the same thing, I'm sure.
Why not?
What do you lose? Right, now the third set of Simon's.
We gotta split this one.
Do you want to split this one?
Let me take the one he made a record of where he made really a fortune. The Grieg. Mr. Rubenstein made a marvelous recording.
That worries you, that fortune that Rubenstein
made. Grieg doesn't worry me.
What were the two of them?
How about Schumann concerto? Those are concertos. One by Schumann, one by Grieg.
Yes, that's quite right.
A minor.
Both in A minor. Well, that seemed to me a remarkable job of answering. I don't know. Seems hard to me. Back in the Middle Ages, one of the classic subjects for learned debate was, which is the most important of man's senses? We'll make that a question for our Heinz reporter, Ben Brower.
Well, I can see how that question could be debatable, even when it comes to enjoying food. To most of us, the pleasure of eating comes not only from the taste, but from the inviting look of a dish and the fragrance of it. And that's why Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup is so satisfying. It's delightful to all three senses. There's nothing more tempting than the pungent, aromatic steam that rises from a hot bowl of Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup. And its rich red color is a feast for the eyes. As for flavor and home-tasting goodness, well, Heinz Condensed Cream of Tomato Soup is made from the finest and juiciest tomatoes that ever ripened on a vine. Big, luscious tomatoes, cooked down to a thick puree the old-fashioned way, slowly, in small batches, and blended with thick, velvety cream. My, what a wonderful way to satisfy your hunger these frosty November days. So give your family Heinz delicious condensed cream of tomato soup often.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now, gentlemen, how about this one from Mrs. Frances Payne of Washington, Connecticut? Name a book title that includes each of these time intervals that I'll mention and explain its meaning in each case. Let's get 2 out of 3. 40 days. 40 days, Mr. Kieran.
40 days of Musadag.
A novel by whom?
Mr. Levant?
Yes, Mr. Kieran, what does the title mean? How does the term 40 days come into it? Do you remember that?
It was a battle going on out there.
Not exactly a battle, but a siege.
Siege.
Who was besieging whom?
The Armenians were being besieged, I think, by the Turks.
Yes, for 40 days in the last war, before they were rescued. That's quite right. A remarkable novel by Franz Werfel. Now, here's another time interval that appears in a book title. 10 days. 10 days, Mr. Adams.
10 days, the trip to the world.
Who wrote it?
John Reed.
And what did Mr. Reed mean by it?
The Russian Revolution.
Yes, the 10 important days of the Russian Revolution in 1917. Quite right. 10 nights. 10 nights. Mr. Levant.
In a barroom thing. In a barroom floor. It took him that long to paint the picture on the floor.
You got several things mixed up with each other, I think, Mr. Adams.
Just 10 nights in the barroom, that's all there is.
That's all there is to it, yeah. Mr. Levant, your answer is as confusing as if you'd spent 10 nights there yourself.
I never drink, that's why I'm so confused.
10 nights in the barroom, as Mr. Adams says, a play standing for the nights misspent in the saloon, or presumably misspent. Who wrote the play, Mr. Adams?
I have no idea.
There's really no reason why you should know. Nobody knows. I'll tell you, however, because I have it down here on a card. William W. Pratt. Poor fellow, never got much credit. So we got 3 out of 3. Try this one from Richard M. Lawrence of Wilmington, Delaware. I'm going to name a group of monarchs, kings, who ruled at the outbreak of the First World War. You tell us who is related to whom and how. Is that clear? I'll name them. There are going to be 5, and they're related in some way. That is, some of them are related to some others. Here we go. George V. Nicholas II, Hakon VII, Wilhelm II, equationships. That's a very difficult job. Mr. Levant,
I'll take Nicky of Russia and King George were cousins.
That's quite right.
And Wilhelm also. They're all through Victoria.
Well, now let's see. Let's get the first. Mr. Rubenstein.
I know them all. I can tell you exactly their family.
You can?
Much better than my own, I think.
Is that so?
Yes, I was always interested in that. I can tell you exactly.
See? All right, go ahead.
William II, the grandson of Queen Victoria, this is George VI. Hakon.
George V. What? He was
George V of England.
Yes, he was his first cousin.
Also, he was also not first cousin, he was also a grandson of Queen Victoria.
Yes, that's right.
Grandson. Cousins.
Now, correct me, Sarah.
Hakon is also being a Danish prince. Danish prince.
He is related to Queen Alexandra.
I didn't even mention her.
And that is the first cousin of Queen George. You see, Queen Alexandra was his father's sister.
I am not more than a mile behind you.
Nicholas II of Russia.
Yes?
Was related through his wife.
What?
And through his mother. Again, was the sister of Queen Alexandra and of King Christian of Denmark.
Good heavens! And do you mean to say, Mr. Rubenstein, that these facts are just coming out now?
All those things I know marvelously well. I can...
Wonderful. Now, you haven't picked this up about the relationship between Hakon the VII and Christian the X, or did you?
Christian the X, they are brothers.
That's right. They are brothers.
Yes.
One to the other, and the other to the one. Hakon of Norway and Christian of Denmark.
Christian of Denmark.
Yes. Now, Mr. Levant.
It's like a moving picture industry in those days.
How do you mean?
That's cryptic. I don't know what I mean.
Cryptic? I don't know. Well, that straightens us out, I believe, about these monarchs at the outbreak of World War I. What a peculiar hobby you have, Mr. Levant. Try this one. From Mrs. Henry G. Buxton of Westchester, Pennsylvania. Where do these descriptive phrases occur? Now, the first phrase is the harmonious blacksmith. Mr. Adams.
That is in a musical piece called The Harmonious Blacksmith.
Indeed it is. And who wrote it?
Handel.
Handel is right, as Mr. Levant tells us. Quite right. The Laughing Cavalier. The Laughing Cavalier. How? What would that mean, Mr. Kieran?
That's a painting by... Oh, golly.
Franz Hals?
Mr. Rubenstein?
Franz Hals.
Franz Hals, yes. So called because the painting is of a cavalier who has a very broad smile on his face. Now, the phrase, the fearless leader, means what? Mr. Adams.
Fearless leader might be either Frank Chance or William Jennings Bryan.
Yes, that's right. It was applied either to the manager of the Chicago Cubs, oh, some 30 years ago, Frank Chance, or to William Jennings Bryan. Here's one from Kay Druck of this city. Who were these people of literature who went from one place to another in the following ways? In the first case, they were fugitives on foot, and the pursuers were in chariots.
Hmm?
The fugitives are on foot and the pursuers in chariots, Mr. Kieran.
The Israelites fleeing from Egypt.
That's quite right. Pursued by the chariots of Pharaoh, swallowed up by the Red Sea. Now, the son who was a student, and his father return home in one carriage, and the son's guest returns home in another carriage. Who are they? That's a very difficult one.
What is that, in the novel?
Yes. I have to call that one wrong. It's from Turgenev's Fathers and Sons. The three characters there, father, son, and Batsarov, the student. I guess that's all we'll have time for. We'll finish that question next time. Thank you, Mr. Rubenstein, for helping out with the fun this evening. And tonight, the H.J. Hines Company must congratulate itself because it has paid out nothing in war bonds and stamps and no sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, a remarkable record. And next week, in addition to Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams, we present a brilliant team of friendly enemies who have been touring the country engaged in a nonstop all-year-round debate. One of them is the well-known author, Lewis Brown, whose novel, See What I Mean, is way up on the bestseller lists nowadays, and the other is the internationally distinguished Nobel Prize winner, Mr. Sinclair Lewis. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York.